I am noticing that when there's only two people, you have far less time to drink.
Yeah.
I'm going to get like,
and also,
it's my turn to talk and all of a sudden I'm halfway through a swig. I'm just saying.
Hello and welcome to Jesuitical, a podcast from the still young, perceptibly hip, and obviously lay editors of America Media. That lay part means we aren't Jesuits, but we work with them. Join us each week for a smart Catholic take on faith, culture, and the news. Often over drinks. I'm Ashley McKinless, and I'm joined by Zach Davis.
Hello, Ashley.
And not Olga this week.
No, it sounds like Olga's come down with a case of something,
yeah,
something
really
not
bad.
Good.
She is on doctor's orders, not supposed to come to the office. So we really miss her, but yep. We're going to try to soldier on.
She just wants to watch the NBA playoffs. I know. I know what she's doing.
How are you doing, Zach?
I'm great. It's America's birthday.
Happy birthday, America.
We are turning 109. We turned 109,
we turned 109
this past
on
Tuesday.
Yes. Which is very exciting.
And we don't look a day over 102. I stole that joke from Carrie Weber. Oh. She made that earlier. But it's true. It's crazy to think. Isn't it a little bit weird to think that when we were born, America was already like 80 years old?
Yeah. Yeah. 78 for me.
So if you want to support the work we do, if you want to say good job America Media for letting those kids host a podcast,
let us survive another 109 years,
may Jesuitical continue for 109 years more, you can visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/America Media.
Yes, that would be very much appreciated.
Yes.
What's on tap, Zach?
So this week we are having a craft brew from Zero Gravity Craft Brewery up in Burlington, Vermont. So we are drinking their dry hopped lager beer.
Keller.
Keller. Mm. Yes. So
right.
Let's crack it open.
Woo.
Cheers.
All right. Cheers.
Mm.
You can really tell the lack of gravity that went into this.
Mm-hmm.
And who's our guest?
So this week we're talking with Patrick Blanchfield, who is an associate professor at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, who is also a freelance writer who writes about American violence, mass shootings, and some of the religious language that infiltrates those debates. That's what we're talking to Patrick about. So
yeah, we talked to him a couple weeks ago. It was in connection to the mass shooting in Florida, but mm-hmm. unfortunately, this is an issue that remains relevant. So it's a great conversation.
But first,
Signs of the Times, the part of our show where we sift through the Catholic news of the week so you don't have to. First, Pope Francis has sent a very strongly worded letter to the bishops in Chile, where he talks about his pain and shame upon getting the report that his representatives in Chile looking into the sex abuse scandal there have given to him. So there's a report over 2,000 pages that goes over the grave abuses that have happened to children in that country. And Pope Francis frankly admits his own, quote, serious mistakes in how he dealt with the scandal.
Mm-hmm. And he's inviting the entire Chilean hierarchy to meet with him at the Vatican. And also he invited the three main accusers of Bishop Juan Barros to meet with him at a different time. But as you pointed out, Ashley, this is, you know, really good to see the Pope admitting his own serious mistakes in dealing with the scandal. And and to ask for forgiveness, that's an important update that we wanted to bring this week.
Yeah. How often do you see a world leader admitting he or she is wrong and asking for forgiveness? Mm-hmm. It's a good model for everyone.
Yeah. So we just hope the momentum that seems to be moving continues to go. We'll see with the meetings, both with the Chilean hierarchy and the survivors.
Yep. All right. What's next?
So we finally have a date. Oscar Romero is getting canonized. It's official. Of particular note, Archbishop Oscar Romero is getting canonized in Rome this fall during the Synod on the Youth.
Yes. And he was the archbishop who was assassinated in El Salvador during that country's civil war. And he's always kind of been like a local saint, but his cause for canonization has been stalled for a number of years because of his connections to liberation theology, which, you know, kind of got a bad name
yes,
in the
to
90s.
Say the least.
But Pope Francis is, you know, he's lifting him up as a model, not only for the people in El Salvador, but for the entire church by having the canonization in Rome.
Right. And we've actually had a few people nominate Romero for canonization on our show.
Yeah. So I won't say this is, you know, take all the credit, but
Ashley's trying to take credit from all those El Salvadoran older women praying to Romero. But yeah,
I'm sure it didn't hurt.
No. So we will soon have Saint Oscar Romero. What's our next story, Ashley?
So this is a follow-up kind of something we talked about last week. We talked about the potential of a U.S. missile strike on Syria in response to the use of chemical weapons by the Assad regime. So since we had that conversation, the U.S., along with the U.K. and France, did strike Syria. We expressed our opposition to those strikes and said that, you know, an alternative is one giving aid, but also letting in refugees who are affected by the violence in this country. And recently, the head of Catholic Relief Services expressed his dismay that the U.S. has really slowed down how many refugees it's letting in from Syria. In 2016, we let in 15,000 Syrian refugees, and this year we've only let in 11. And if we continue at that rate, we will only have 50 Syrian refugees settled in the U.S. in 2018. And this is, I mean, even 15,000 is a tiny, tiny percentage of the 10 million Syrians who have been displaced by this war.
This is the thing we should be, I mean, again, as you said, yeah, we're always ready to advocate to do something, right? But it's always in terms of military force. And this is a very clear thing that we can advocate for and push for, that we are falling so far short on. It's not laughable. It's so sad.
Yeah. And Edward Clancy, the head of Aid to the Church in Need, has called on people. He said if they feel that something needs to be done, then they should contact their congressman or senator to say that we have to make sure that these people have every opportunity for life, because that's what it comes down to. So if you're concerned about this, contact your representative. All right, what's next, Zach?
Seven Catholic Peace activists were arrested and denied bond for their role in protesting at King's Naval Base in Georgia. They were there protesting the installation of nuclear weapons. They showed up carrying hammers and baby bottles of their own blood, and they entered the base with an indictment charging the U.S. government for crimes against peace. And so they were arrested for trespassing, basically, and have been denied bond, and so there will be an official charging in trial set for later date. But we brought this story to highlight sort of the age of the protesters.
Yeah. So those were seven Catholic protesters aged 55 to 78. So like, that's amazing. Good on them.
Yeah. So first of all, we should just say like, they're doing great work and prophetic work.
Yeah. And work that they've been doing
their
many
entire
of these
lives.
Since the 60s civil rights movement, you mm-hmm. know, onward. But we've been having these conversations in the office and with our readers about where are the millennial activists. One of the O'Hare fellows here in America, Colleen Dully, wrote an article titled that, "Where are the millennial activists?"
Millennial Catholic activists.
Millennial Catholic activists. And her point was, it's not that millennials aren't, you know, out there like protesting. There are, you know, Black Lives Matter, the Women's March, millennials are there, but they're not doing this activism in an explicitly Catholic context. You know, we've been debating, like, is this a problem? Is it better that there are Catholics in these movements representing, you know, the Catholic faith to the larger culture? Or would it be better if they were, you know, like their boomer forebears protesting as Catholics?
Right. And as you said, that, you know, a lot of people, I mean, at the March for Life, they're explicit. There are a lot of young people prominently featured as they're with their parishes and their youth groups mm-hmm. And their pro-life clubs at their Catholic schools. And that's sort of the only prominent place where they're, you know, doing civil disobedience under a Catholic banner. And I think this is a huge miss.
Yeah.
There are a few organizations that do a good job of mentoring yeah. young people, but there's a huge shortage of them.
Yeah.
And this is a huge opportunity for evangelization to young people. But also, it's more than that.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm kind of skeptical that, like, you know, if the church had better protest movements, then young people would flock back to it.
That's fair.
If young people want to protest, there are plenty of people doing that very effectively outside of the church. And the church would have a long way to go to catch up to have that be its main selling point.
Well, that brings up a good point, is that, like, the church would benefit from having these young people in. This would be like a mutual evangelization of sorts, mm-hmm. right? So like, young people would be able to feel confirmed in their Catholic identity. And also the church would be evangelized by living out its mission better with the energy of young people.
Yeah.
So it's this dual thing that we're missing out on.
Yeah. All right, listeners, are you a Catholic millennial? And would you consider yourself an activist? What are you doing?
Do you wish the church was there? Maybe not. But I think the church should humbly present an option for young people who do want to do this.
Speaking of evangelizing young people through unconventional means, some nuns in Poland have taken YouTube by storm with a video of them boxing and doing other physical feats.
Yes. So the Capuchin Sisters of the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus are hoping to raise money for their orphanage. And so they made a pretty unique video.
Yeah, no, so they are in the gym in full habits, punching bags and each other, doing jump rope. So they're raising money for their orphanage, but also trying to reach a wider audience by, you know, showing the world that nuns can
slug, you know, they're punching it out to the theme song from Rocky. And Mother Superior did need to point out that we'd like to stress no one was knocked out or injured, which is impressive because I might have thrown out a shoulder if I were doing the types of moves that these nuns were doing.
This is true. Another video came out this week.
Yes. Oh, my God. If you need a good cry, you've probably already seen this, but Pope Francis was visiting a group of parishes on the outskirts of Rome who have been suffering from some like public housing crisis, and sort of part and parcel with a papal visit are question and answers from children. And so there were some typical questions like, oh, what was it like when you first were elected? What did you think? But then there was a little boy named Emmanuel who approached the microphone to ask Pope Francis's question, and he starts to tremble a little bit, and then he starts to cry, and then the Monsignor who's tending the microphone sort of tries to encourage him, and Emmanuel just kind of starts saying, I can't, while crying. And so Pope Francis just says, Emmanuel, come to me, whisper your question in my ear. At that point, you know, Emmanuel gets up to Pope Francis, and he's sobbing at this point, and so Pope Francis just pulls him in, embraces him, and then they have a conversation for a few minutes. They're whispering in each other's ear. And then Pope Francis asked Emmanuel if he could share his question with the whole audience. And Emmanuel said yes. And Emmanuel wanted to know that his father had passed away recently, and he himself was not a believer, but he had all four of his children baptized, and that he was a good man. And he wanted to ask Pope Francis, is my dad in heaven?
I'm going to cry again just listening to you tell this.
I know, and it's such a... It's such a tough question, and it's one that only like children can be so blunt with.
Yeah.
I think a lot of that's such a relatable question that a lot of people want to know, like, especially if you've stayed in your faith and you've seen loved ones fall away from it, and you want them to have a relationship with God that they might not have had in this life, but you want to extend in eternal life. And Pope Francis, you know, responded like,
yeah,
such a pastor.
Yeah, he said he was good. And he said, if a man was able to make his children like that, like Emmanuel, so open and willing to share,
well, and he said,
then it's true. He was a good man.
And he was praising Emmanuel. One of the first things he said was, I wish that we could all be as brave as Emmanuel to be okay to cry when we have a wound in our heart like that. Like, if this man could have made his son so brave like Emmanuel, then he must have been a good man. So first, just to affirm like this really positive image of masculinity that is not said often enough, that it is okay to cry, and it's okay to cry in front of other people, right? And then the question that he gave such a good answer after that.
Yeah, he said, God has a dad's heart, and with a dad who was not a believer, but who baptized his children and gave them that bravura, I think means bravery.
Yes.
Do you think God would be able to leave him far from himself?
And then the children like all respond like, no. And then he says, well, Emmanuel, there's your answer. Like, ugh.
Yeah.
So this is why we love Pope Francis, to be able to sort of not only respond that way, but like see the person in front of him. It's a crying 8-year-old who misses his dad.
And not get bogged down with like, oh, like what's the doctrine of,
right. Well,
of
it was the,
universal salvation. Like, no, he's a pastor. He treated this young boy as a pastor, as a father, really. Mm-hmm. And it's really beautiful.
So I was watching this, and I thought one question we could ask ourselves is, if you had the chance to ask Pope Francis a question, what would you ask him? Why? Send us an email, jesuitical@americanmedia.org.
Today, joining us via Skype is Patrick Blanchfield. He is an associate faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research and a writer on issues like U.S. culture, violence, and politics. Welcome to Jesuitical, Patrick.
Hey, hello. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, we're very excited to have you. So once again, we've kind of seen the issue of gun control kind of thrust into the forefront of the media. Why do you think it's so difficult for us as a nation to talk about gun control?
That's a phenomenal question. And sort of like it's the recurring question in all these mm-hmm. things. One thing I sort of stipulate at the outset is that a lot of times is sort of pushing at the question of what does gun control sort of denote? When you say the words gun control, people start thinking, you know, they think Dianne Feinstein on the floor of Congress holding up a gun. They think cops knocking on doors. They think the NRA. It activates this whole well-worn series of cultural responses that have been pretty much played out. And we all sort of know how we feel about these things, and they activate all these interest groups and the like. But that those sort of debates oftentimes exist independent from our thinking in a very sustained way about the problem of gun violence much more broadly, right? Which is not reducible to like what we mean by gun control, right? A lot of what people talk about gun control might involve like police violence, which, you know, is a type of gun violence. Right. So it's sort of our difficulty thinking through like what do we mean when we talk about gun control? What do we mean when we talk about gun violence? And why do those two conversations sometimes almost feel like they're proceeding like spinning plates or in parallel to each other rather than connecting?
And is that because when we do have debates about gun control, it's often in response to mass shootings, and that's just a very small part of gun violence?
Yeah, that's precisely right. And so the conversation becomes very narrowly about preventing what is essentially rampage violence in public spaces that impact certain sets of people, namely, you know, college students, high school students, office workers, churchgoers, et cetera. But implicitly, that accepts a whole other category of violence or other different kinds of gun violence as being normal and acceptable.
So we're talking about this more than a month after the last rampage shooting in Parkland, Florida. And the fact that we're still talking about it and people in the media are still talking about it is different. Usually we do have the well-worn script of mass shooting, 1 week of attention, moving on. You know, at the March for Our Lives, there were representatives from, you know, inner city violence or suicide, that sort of thing. Do you see this as a different script?
Yes, this moment is different. I do think, this moment is I think very different and very like pregnant with possibility. I mean, my job, I'll speak from like my personal perspective, right, which is a little weird, which is that I've been writing about gun violence and mass shootings for about 6 years now. And for many years, it had been this thing where something awful happens, my phone just explodes, and I'm doing interviews and I'm doing pieces and I'm constantly talking to people for about a week and a half, and then nothing. And then the same thing happens 2 weeks later, and then, these odd cycles of forgetting and then horror and then sort of retreat and exasperation and resignation. It's a very sad landscape. This time does feel different. And I think that has a lot to do with both the specific advocacy of the players involved, these kids. It has a lot to do with where they're coming from and who they are and what they represent. But it also has a lot to do with like sustained capacity building on the part of anti-gun violence organizations. And also, I think there has been this kind of, I don't want to call it like a sweet spot, but it hit this very particular spot of the national conversation being just exhausted beyond exhaustion, and then also just the white community feeling the brunt of this. And then they're springing very nobly into activist roles on that.
Well, you've written before that it's not super useful to think of the gun debate in terms of conservative and liberal. Why is that not super useful? And what are better ways to think of it?
If you take a view of American history that's more than just like a 4 or 5 year election cycle, mm-hmm. And look in the way in which guns and gun ownership have been a contested category, it becomes pretty clear that the issue is not the guns themselves, it's who's carrying them. In 1968, when the Black Panthers mounted the steps of the California Capitol carrying guns, Ronald Reagan launched what was, you know, the first, what is recognizably modern gun control in response to that, right? This is Ronald Reagan, governor of California, like saying the people like, there's no reason for a reasonable citizen who wants to do anything good to be walking around with a loaded weapon. I'm paraphrasing the quote, but something like that, right? So at that point, I'm like, well, is this a lot of the things that Reagan was suggesting, a lot of these sort of basic moral attitudes that, well, no one should be needing to do this. Like, when you actually look at the context, like, these are not, a lot of those phrases could be in the mouth of a contemporary liberal, right? But you know, there they were definitely being applied for fairly reactionary specific purposes. So, and then if you move closer to the present, right, it becomes clear that a lot of things that liberals will otherwise be, with good reason, be skeptical about, right, hopefully will be skeptical about, like certain types of policing measures, certain types of security state growth, like, you know, no-fly lists and all this other stuff. When it comes to guns, a lot of liberals will suddenly very closely resemble their conservative brethren and being like, well, you know, we need to give the cops more power. And so at that point, it doesn't seem to be just narrowly about the guns. It appears to be about maintaining certain distributions of power and recourse to violence.
And that's still the case today, because I think a lot of people, you know, the political dynamics have shifted and it's thought of as very much, and this is true in like my own family and friends, that if you vote Republican or if you're a conservative, you generally are for carrying guns in the Second Amendment. And if you don't, then you want gun control, whatever that means. And I feel like a lot of the times, this has been my experience, is that even when I wanted more gun control, I hadn't thought super critically about these questions of like what types of control and what types of violence we're trying to stop. So is that still the case today?
I think that's absolutely the case right now. And it's also why, like, I'm really heartened by what I'm seeing from the Parkland Never Again people, and also mm-hmm. just by, like, the engagement of a lot of other people with them online and in like, the physical world. Insofar as that, like, you know, it's still on, like, some of the survivors have certain specific demands. Other survivors are asking for other things, right? So there are a lot of people whose response to this is like, well, we need more cops in schools, right? That's not just a conservative. To their credit, a lot of Parkland survivors have said, no, we don't need more cops in schools. They're actually the opposite. We need the exact opposite. We need fewer school resource officers. Like, the purpose of school resource officers, and I think here, not just what the Parkland kids are saying, but by books, by like a good book by Alex Vitale called The End of Policing that I highly recommend, that breaks down this, like, school resource officers basically exist to shovel certain kids into a school to prison pipeline. Right. And to also, you know, deal with kids who are like, there's a non-trivial amount of children who act out in schools. They're disproportionately Black and brown, who it's advantageous for school authorities to have put into disciplinary programs or into juvenile hall, both because they're no longer in the classroom, but also because that brings up school test scores.
Right.
Right. So there's a way in which, like, the issue of asking for gun control narrowly very easily can bleed into feeding all these other mechanisms of social injustice. And what's making this moment so exciting is that even though there are a lot of very traditionalists having assault weapons ban, let's have more cops in schools voices, there are also a lot of voices being like, no, we just need to be the less violent culture as a whole, and we need to undo that structural violence in addition to just the narrow gun violence you see. Like, America's a very violent country. Like, we're super invested in monetizing death. And we're really invested in having a lot of cognitive dissonance about this,
yeah.
Right? You hear, like, even Democratic politicians will be like, well, we can't have these weapons of war on our streets. I'm like, well, whose streets do they belong on, right? A lot of people want to have their a lot of the gun control stuff that has previously failed, that I think been very, like, immoral, and I feel comfortable using this language with you all, has been stuff that's been like, basically, well, can we just enforce harder at home while still keeping our role as the world's biggest arms manufacturer and a military empire? And, you know, it's morally misbegotten, and it's not going to work.
I'll never remember when I realized that, like, when we banned assault weapons, that Mexico's murder rate mm-hmm. shot up, right? And it's like, whose lives do we consider valuable in this country?
Yeah, I think one of the interesting things about this debate is that from both sides, it always kind of attracts this, like, very theological reactions. And what do you think about, Patrick? Is there sort of this tendency to theologize, like, on both sides of the argument?
Well, this is very important to me. I have a Jesuit education. This is very important for me. Like, and definitely, there's an obvious theology when you hear a lot of people, specifically on the right wing, talk about, you know, this is a tragedy. We just need to pray, mm-hmm. right? That there was, which is a kind of like a non-reaction, right? It depoliticizes this stuff. It makes the point at which, like, you have senators with an A+ NRA rating who have actively worked to liberalize gun access, being like, there's nothing we can do. All we can do is pray. Like, this is, it's a bad parody of the Book of Job, right? Like, there's some way in which, like, I'm not knocking prayer as an activity, but prayer from the powerful who have made the situation worse, it's terrible.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I do have a question about that, because I agree that prayer is clearly not the, like, only appropriate response. But do you think it's helpful when people, like denounce other people for praying? Like, is that going to help us get anything done? Because that has become another predictable script where people give their thoughts and prayers, and then people on the other side yell at them for giving their thoughts and prayers.
Yeah, this is that gets at one of those, like, ideas, like these pathways or like this ruts in the road, right? Like, if someone says prayer, then there's going to be some, there's going to be some unfortunate person who's like, well, prayer is bad and you're an idiot. Like, yeah. The sheer repetition with which we've done this has produced this entire ecology of postures and stupid responses and bad positions. And it's a real petri dish for this. So yeah, no, of course prayer is great. I encourage pray if you want. But
has your Jesuit education shaped at all how you think about responding to events like this?
I guess it has in some ways. I mean, actually, I'll get to that in 1 second. Let me just give you another, because it's not the theological stuff isn't just on the right, where it's a lot like essentially bullshit theology, right? Like. Mm-hmm. I think we understand a lot of suffering in this country relative to a template of sacrifice and relative to these very sophisticated but rarely articulated logics of moral desert and justified suffering. So, for example, the idea that, you know, the kids in Sandy Hook are little angels, but the young black men who were killed on the streets in Ferguson are, you know, they're thugs, as opposed to simply having a very clear moral standard, which is that no one deserves to get shot ever. Right? So there's a sort of moral filtering that happens where it's like we start choosing these particular people who, like, these people don't deserve to suffer, but these people, their suffering is acceptable, right? So that's a theological dimension there too. But there's also the way in which sacrifice plays into it, where it's like the logic of sacrifice is very frequently a logic of atonement, right? This is more of a Christological thing. It's a broader Judeo-Christian thing, but the idea that, like, somehow sacrifice is purgative, like, if there's some, and this is present on the right, where people are like, well, the loss of all these kids, it's the price we pay for freedom. This is a former NRA vice president who coined this line. In testimony before Congress, someone asked him, well, what do you feel about people like criminals having access to guns who shouldn't, or the mentally ill killing people? His response was, well, that's the price we pay for freedom, verbatim. Now, of course, that we is you push and be like, well, no, it's not we, it's some of us who are not necessarily the people who are saying that.
Right.
But also the idea that, like, there's some sort of redemptive principle at play here.
And you see that on the left as well?
I see it sometimes in terms of our emotional desires, right? Like our desire to, like, have some sort of cathartic response, right? Something, this massacre has happened, we have to do something. And the idea there I'm not judging it per se, right? That impulse is right, but there's a hope that somehow we could take some action that could make us feel as morally vindicated as the tragedy that we just witnessed makes us feel implicated and terrible. I'll leave it to the theologians to talk about the metaphysical logic of, like, of sacrifice in a theological sense. But, like, I have a very hard time imagining any political action that could redeem the mass murder of 20 children.
Yeah.
Right? And I have a hard idea also of, like, I question any, I have my own moral qualms with thinking that there's anything, that making it about my feelings in the first place, about our feelings in the first place, right? The idea that these kids who were murdered are going to, we're going to make good their sacrifice by what? Right.
By yelling at our family members, mm-hmm. or owning the conservatives, or owning the libs, or doing all these things that, like, you just want to jump into a cesspool because, like, that's what you're faced with, right? Like, with all this suffering.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I think that's a super relatable.
Yeah.
I assume you don't think there should be no response. So what do you want to see going forward when we have these debates and when we try to implement some sort of response?
I'm getting this question a lot more now, and I like getting it. It's a good thing people are thinking about this, right? Like, but the first thing I'd say is just really I want us to have a, it's not a non-response, but I want us to have a reflective response. Well, when we see one specimen act of violence that's like headline grabbing, to stop and be like, how does this example of violence reflect broader systems of violence?
That sounds a lot like a genuine thought and prayer.
But yeah, so there's that, like, just being like, how do we, like maybe America, maybe when we talk about school shooting, we should be talking about making, like, if we're worried about school shootings, maybe we should be a little more worried about, you know, about making America less violent overall, like being not, maybe we should question, you know, I'm not using the we as Catholics because I'm not one, but like, maybe folks of goodwill and good intention might want to question their desire to exist in a military superpower. Or maybe it's funny how the country that also has the most guns in private hands also has the most, both per capita and in total, also has per capita and in total the most people in prison, right? Maybe these are related problems, right? So that's something, so something that's other than a purely knee-jerk, let's make ourselves feel better by pissing off the NRA or pissing off our red state uncle, but something like how can we have a holistic, I hate to use the phrase seamless garment, but a more sort of like cohesive vision of human life and dignity that we can protect. And in terms of other stuff, like in terms of concrete policy stuff, like, yeah, like we need to, my friend Jennifer Carlson, whose work is brilliant, she's a sociologist at Toronto and now at Arizona, has a book called Citizen Protectors that I strongly recommend. But her conclusion in that book is that we need to make guns less socially relevant. Gun violence is the tip of the iceberg of broader systems of violence and oppression and people feeling, you know, much in the same way as like suicide. 2/3 of our gun deaths are going to be suicides in any given year, right? It's 20,000 people. Like that's an act of, I think in most cases, of despair and should be preventable, and people should not feel the need to do this, right? And so maybe we should intervene rather than, you know, let's just take away the guns. So of course we should, we should have those conversations, but to also intervene on the systems of suffering and misery that make this type of outcomes practicable.
Real quick, if you could give, like, if you see the good, bad, and like worse, what's going to happen?
A couple of years ago, I wrote a piece about going to a gun show in Georgia. And I got the affect I felt there most was fear, right? Mm-hmm. And I ended this piece being like, what are people most afraid of? And a couple months later, I got a letter sent to me by a Catholic worker affiliated association called the Open Door Community that had been working with death row inmates and people who were working lifers. And they had printed out a copy of the article and distributed it to some people that they work with inside. And a man who was serving life for a really horrific home invasion and double murder, and who had since rediscovered his Catholicism in prison, read it and wrote back to me. And the line, like, is he quoted Augustine to me, actually. It was sort of the amazing thing. And it was just like, well, you know, I did what I did. I'm not asking for excuses, but everything I did was done out of a sense of impotence and fear. And the line specifically that he quoted to me was that you cannot love with fear in your heart. And I still think about, I had this letter again, written by, he killed a toddler. But having his own story of like abuse and vulnerability, and then going on to kill other people and being like, the root of all this was fear. Right. So if you want like a philosophical, theological thing, we need to think about fear, right? And what we're afraid of in terms of good, bad, worse. Good is we get serious about not just asking for gun control, but just about building down how violent we are as a society. We disarm our police, we disarm ourselves, and we eliminate the structural conditions that make people want to hurt each other and themselves.
Yeah.
Bad is we maintain what we're doing consistently, right? Just a basic status quo. We continue to enrich arms companies. We continue to grow the police. And we continue to basically accept the fact that the same amount of people that die of car accidents and drug overdoses are about the same that we lose to guns in every given year. That's bad. Worse is we go full on, we go even more into the security state policing. We put police everywhere. Our understanding of gun control is just putting people in prison, and we just militarize further. And I think we actually are at a point where all three of those scenarios are equally possible, and I really hope we go for the first. So if I were a praying man, I'd pray that gets it.
Well, thank you so much, Patrick. We've got one more question for you. If you could canonize anyone living or dead, Catholic or non-Catholic, who would it be and why?
As a non-praying man.
As a non-praying man. Who would you make a saint?
For others to pray to.
Jesus.
do you say Jesus? I don't think he needs your help.
I can think of clerics I know who've done a lot of work on gun violence and who I would, they're still living, so I wouldn't want to canonize them ahead of time. I think more about the martyrs. And we have a lot of them. Trayvon Martin. I can't stop thinking about Trayvon Martin. It's been years. I can't. I think that there's a whole roster of names that we've known for headlines or just people who have been forgotten and this daily churn. And I don't know who to elevate as a specimen example of a person who I would write a hagiography about or look to for divine intercession. But I think that thinking about this constant toll that's not reducible to any logic of redemption, but is really about witnessing and about a call to action, I would think about that.
Amen. I mean, martyrs and companions. I mean, there's a lot of instances in the church where like names just get lost, but you still want to elevate their examples. So, amen.
Yeah. So let's canonize martyrs of gun violence.
Well, this has been really great. So,
yeah, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Keep doing what you're doing. Keep writing.
Thanks, Patrick.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right, now it's time for some listener feedback. Got a couple of really nice emails this week. One from Jake Shemtob, a graduate of Fairfield University, who recently was going on a road trip and was introduced to Jesuitical and then binged our entire library, which I highly encourage to anyone who's just finding us.
Only after you've done a solid bout of country music with the windows down. That is official road trip music. And
all right.
Maybe then after that,
okay,
go to Jesuitical. We also had an email from Cara Marie, who wrote that she's listening to Jesuitical while studying for finals. And it's that time of the year.
Is it really?
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
It's final season. So if you're a student out there and you're studying for finals, you're getting ready for them, you can do it. May you have many consolations come out of your exams.
And when you need a study break, Jesuitical is here for you.
One more email was from Clarice Wilson, who wrote that as an expat sort of living abroad in looking at our current political climate, she wanted to know like how she could do something for the refugee situation and the migrant situation. She was really moved by our discussion of the migrant caravan last week and feels sort of powerless. I guess one thing I would say is we had a really great interview with the Director of Advocacy and Operations, I think was her title, of Jesuit Refugee Services, Julie McPherson, back in January. That episode is called, aptly, One Thing You Can Do to Support Migrants and Refugees. So give that a listen and I think keep asking these questions.
Mm-hmm. And finally, we want to give a shout out to our new patrons, Mary Quinlan, Michelle Frankel-Donay, Anna Mahoney, Bob Gorman, Christy Steinman, and a special shout out to VIP Verity Caruso. Thank you all so much for supporting Jesuitical.
Yeah, that means
it really does.
Lot. It keeps the lights on here.
Mm-hmm. The bright blue lights.
Yes.
And yes, one more reminder, birthday week here at America. And so check us out at patreon.com/AmericaMedia.
It is proper to give one a gift on one's birthday.
Now it's time for Consolations and Desolations, the part of our show where we talk about where we found God this week and where it was harder to find God. What do you have, Zach?
So I've got a desolation, and it's related to, I guess, my professional life and my work life, you know, sort of outside of Jesuitical. I feel like I'm being given a lot of tasks that don't necessarily, that are problems that don't have a lot of answers to, that no one really has the answers right now. I don't know the answers. And there is this, I feel like I'm listening to the evil spirit a lot right now, which is also telling me you're never going to figure it out. You can't figure it out. And the tempting thing is to think all three of those are true. And the truth is one of them is, I don't know. And I have to be honest with that and to be able to see the whole situation. But The temptation is to listen to the evil spirit say, you're not going to be able to, and you never will. It's sort of telling, I'm hearing a lot of, you're plateauing, you're not going to do any better. And that feels horrible. That sucks. And I know that's not true, but it really blocks my ability to be grateful for the work that I do and for the good, for like the good we're doing here, and to be able to like actually get somewhere where I can solve some of these harder problems.
Yeah. I'm sure you can solve the crisis of modern journalism in the age of the internet, Zach.
I know. Staring at analytics. Just read more articles. If you're listening to this, read all of our articles a lot more.
No, just click on them. Just click on them. You don't even have to read. Yeah. Just leave it open.
That'd
just
be
kidding.
Great.
Really, read them. We create a lot of great content outside of podcast.
Yes. So that's my desolation. Ashley, what do you got?
I have a consolation, which is also kind of work related. So at the beginning of the year, I looked ahead to my March and April and saw this like never ending streak of public speaking events that I had signed myself up for, kind of like taking a leap of faith that I would get over my fear of public speaking and just like do it. So I can now, I'm almost at the end of it.
Yeah.
I have a parish talk on Friday. So I still have to prepare for that. But I can now look back at like a couple of live shows, a presentation I gave at a Jesuit high school, and see that I survived.
if you can speak in front of high school boys.
Yeah, that's... it was terrifying. So where I see God in this is one in like the trust I had going into it, that it was scary but worth it because it is something I was doing things I care about, but also in the strength in getting through it. Like I did not do it alone because I couldn't have done it alone. So I see God in propping me up through that and
getting over those fears.
Getting over the fear,
yeah,
of public speaking, which I clearly still have.
I don't see it.
Thanks, Zach.
All right, get us out of here, Ashley.
I will. Jesuitical is brought to you by America Media and produced by Eloise Blondio. Our editor is Noah Levinson. Jesuit formation provided by Eric Sundrup, SJ. Engineering and design by Angelou Jesus Canta. Adverbs provided by Eloise Blondio. You can follow us on Twitter at Jesuitical Show, and please subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite podcasts and leave us a review. We didn't get any last week.
Yeah.
And it makes us very sad.
Come on.
just one or 10.
Yeah.
It'd be great. We'll give
it's
you
our
a shout
birthday.
Out. And send us your questions, feedback, cocktail recipes, and tell us where you found God this week at jesuitical@americamedia.org. For America Media, I'm Ashley McKinless with Zach Davis. We will see you next week.